Welcome to the Metta Hour with Sharon Salzberg, where Buddhist wisdom meets everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network and features interviews with the top leaders, teachers, and thinkers of the mindfulness movement and beyond. For more information, visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I'm delighted to be speaking today with Dr. Will Vanderveer and Keith Kurlander. Will and Keith are co-founders of the Integrative Psychiatry Institute, which teaches mental health providers how to recognize and resolve an expanded spectrum of root causes of mental illness, and also the Integrative Psychiatry Centers, which provide integrative psychiatry and ketamine-assisted psychotherapy for complex mental health challenges. Together, they are the hosts of the Higher Practice podcast. Will is a psychiatrist, speaker, researcher, and author. He is a diplomat of the American Board of Integrative Medicine and has been a team member on several studies sponsored by MAPS investigating MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for chronic treatment-resistant PTSD. Keith graduated from Naropa University in 2005 with a master's degree in transpersonal counseling psychology. And he has practiced integrative psychotherapy and coaching with individuals, couples, and groups for over 15 years. Welcome both of you to the podcast.
Thanks, Sharon. It's great to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to get into the conversation with you, Sharon.
Well, thank you, really. This is such a poignant time. You know, I'm teaching online and I'm reading the chats, and as people are, you know, writing in their life experience, and it's so tough. And it's important, I think, to turn to many bodies of knowledge, you know, to feel what some options might be for seeking help or for offering help, and so on. So I wanted to understand more about integrative psychiatry and find out how you both came to specialize in it.
Sure, I'll start us off. This is Keith. So I'll first say, you know, Will and I have known each other now for close to 15 years, I think. We're very close friends and been very close colleagues. And my road into integrative psychiatry and the companies we're both involved in is very different than Will's. So I'll just say a little bit about me. So I, by training, I'm a psychotherapist. And my road to integrative psychiatry was really as a patient. I won't tell the long detailed story here, but I dealt with pretty severe mental illness for what turned out to be most of my life, which I didn't realize until I was a young adult. A lot of serious depression, bipolar states, and severe ADD, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And that catapulted me on a journey, a spiritual journey in my 20s that brought me to more of the Eastern traditions, meditation, yoga, and then brought me to wanting to help people as a psychotherapist. And then through my own professional and personal pursuit, realized that there's actually a model out there for healing that brings everything together in the space of mental health, where there are, you know, people that identify with mental health struggles. There's a modality out there that's we're kind of defining more right now through this institute and our center called integrative psychiatry, and it's a pretty amazing model of healing and human potential. Really, it's a human potential model. And I think I'll leave it at that for the moment. I won't say too much more about what it is. Maybe, Will, you want to say a little bit more about your path, and
sure,
you want to get into details there.
No, it sounds great. Yeah, I would. So, as a psychiatrist, I learned pretty quickly after I finished my training that the medications and the psychotherapy that I learned about in my training and was taught to provide people helped some people, but it left too many people in deep suffering. And within a couple of years after graduating residency, I was in despair about the limitations in the tools that I had learned. And at first, I went to meditation and I started teaching my patients how to meditate and be with their disturbances. And that did help quite a bit. But then I realized that there were still too many people suffering beyond just medication and therapy and meditation. So over the years, kind of scoured the continuing education space for how to learn about other ways to help people get well. And that really led into looking at the gut-brain connection and the microbiome and the role of inflammation and learning how to work with trauma in a somatic psychotherapy approach. And over the years, developed a kind of a broad range of ways to evaluate the problems people face that became the basis of what we teach in the Institute.
Fantastic. And actually, I want to take what might seem like a little detour into that word despair.
Sure.
That I like just detours. Because as I think we talked about when I was talking to you on your podcast, the a lot of the work I've been doing in the last several years has been with what we call caregivers. People, I always think there needs to be a better word, but people who in many ways in their personal life and their professional life are on the front lines of suffering, trying to make a difference, trying to help people, whether it's the family or whatever. And it's tough. That itself, you know, is a professional stance that's leading to a lot of trauma and vicarious trauma. And there's just the nature of trying to be of service anyway, where you don't necessarily see immediate results. You don't necessarily get exactly the results that you wanted. And yet your heart is telling you, you have to keep trying. And so whenever I hear a caregiver, which I'm now defining you as, use a word like despair, I just want to ask, well, what did you do for coming back to balance? Because this is a very crucial question in our time.
Mm. Thanks for asking that, Sharon. The first thing I did was I quit psychiatry. Mm-hmm. And then I followed my meditation teacher to a tiny town in Colorado called Crestone. And I started a kind of retreat-like existence where I was practicing meditation for several hours a day. Meditation was one of the only resources I had at the time for my healing process. And it remains really important to me today. I've kind of filled it out a little bit since then, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. It took me a while to sit with myself and begin to open my mind to the perspective that it wasn't psychiatry that was wrong. It was just that psychiatry was very limited in the scope of what it taught me in as a healer. So that was the first thing I did.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I would love to hear, you know, from both of you. And also, obviously, it's a huge question in our time. And so how are you counseling people who are maybe not ready to quit or move to Crestone, you know, where I've been?
Yeah. Right.
I'm so glad, Sharon, you're bringing up the experience of despair, both in the care providers and also just in the human experience, and that it's very heightened in a lot of people right now, mm-hmm. the experience of despair and existential angst. I think that's one thing. I'm not sure what you've seen in your work, Sharon, but something I've seen is that I think there's the bittersweetness of despair, because despair definitely, you know, in one level, I categorize despair in my brain as sort of unnecessary suffering, and it's like we could do better, sort of like perspective. And another way, what I've seen in myself and a lot of the community I'm involved with care providers is that despair seems to light a fire of wanting to really help in some way around suffering. It doesn't do that for everyone, but I see that despair also is something that can turn into something through sort of alchemy, spiritual alchemy, can turn into something that becomes purpose in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And a way to really impact the world in a significant way. So I think we're at a very interesting moment in history right now where there is increased despair and angst. But I also believe that that alchemy can turn to increased purpose in the world and influence and change.
That's so interesting. And so when a caregiver comes to you, obviously you're assessing the whole person, as you described the process of integrative psychiatry, but particularly around that kind of burnout of trying to be of service, the exhaustion or the depletion or the sense of meaninglessness that sometimes comes when one is just too tired, is that a place where you, how do you help somebody like that or try to help somebody like that?
Right. Well, we start from the bottom up. I would say we want to take a look at the entire ecosystem of the person in front of us, including their relationships with their loved ones, with their friends and their community and, their place in the world. And then we're also going to look at their habits. We're going to look at their nutrition. We're going to look at their sleep. We're going to start with the basics. One of the things that I see a lot in distressed caregivers is sleep disturbance. So that's a really undermining problem that people face. And it's also a lever that can have a huge impact if we can get a hold of that and work with sleep. But on the psychological or spiritual level with despair, I think we also have to look at what are the assumptions about how the universe works. What are our assumptions about our responsibility for guaranteeing positive outcomes for the people we work with to try to alleviate their suffering? Oftentimes caregivers, more often than not in my experience, and I'm speaking from personal experience as well, often come from backgrounds where they performed caregiving roles as children in the family system. And so if those unconscious patterns are operating, they can really undermine a person's health.
Yeah, I could fill in a few more gaps here. Okay. So I think everything Will said is kind of my perspective and kind of blowing out a little of what Will said, because I tend to focus a lot on psychology mostly refer to other people for the other components of the wheel Will was speaking to. To me, when a caregiver is, quote unquote, burned out or exhausted or depleted, despair, to me, that typically means that in some way they're not acting in accordance with to what's most important to them. Their value structure in some way is shifted in their head and their behaviors aren't, they're not spending enough time on behaviors that are most important to them. Because when we spend time on behaviors that we believe will give us what's most important to us in our life, and a lot of the time in the day is spent on those behaviors, we're automatically inspired because we start getting more of what we want in our life. When we start spending time on behaviors that lead to things that are less important to us, then all of a sudden the exchange doesn't feel accurate in ourselves because we're not actually getting the thing that most fulfills us. So I would usually look at the caregiver who's saying, I'm burned out and depleted or in despair, and say, let's really look at your behaviors and the way you're, you know, using your energy throughout the day. And are you actually working toward the thing you most want throughout the day? Because typically when we work through the thing we most want, we tend to actually feel very energized because we're getting the thing we want. So that's just an extra piece I would throw in around values. To me, burnout typically is we're limited in some way in the way we're working, and it's not actually the way we want to be working. That's typically my experience, especially with caregivers.
There's also the very interesting question of self-compassion, and I'm wondering about that, you know, just in general, because to, first of all, not have completely unrealistic, perfectionistic standards, and to have some resiliency to be able to begin again, things like that, to have an ability to change directions or have some flexibility in your perception day to day and with everything that we need to do, we fall down a lot and we blow it. And, you know, conditions now are very hard, which I want to talk to you about as well. And people are finding they're maybe reacting in a harsher way than they might have like 2 months ago, 3 months ago, 4 months ago, whatever it might be. And so for me, you know, my perspective is that the hidden ingredient in all of that and being able to kind of make a mistake, lessons learned, go on with some greater determination or have to start over with something or do a course correction or whatever it might be. The basis of that is really self-compassion.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Sharon, and because you're one of the best people to ask this, just in, you know, where have you really spent your time in terms of helping people? Like, what would you say are the ingredients of self-compassion in terms of what allows someone to be able to exercise self-compassion, and where do people get kind of stuck in maybe self-aggression?
Well, I'd go back to Kristin Neff's, you know, basic formula for describing self-compassion, which I think is great. And it involves mindfulness, first of all, seeing what you're feeling, that something is going on and you're adding, you know, a tremendous amount of shame to the fact that your mind wandered in meditation, or you didn't say something quite in as elegant a way as you had hoped, or whatever it is. And then feel what that shame is like. You know, what does it feel like? And as one psychologist said to me once, the brain filled with shame cannot learn. You know, and so we pay attention to what that feels like. And if it feels like it's closed off and shuttered and, you know, isolating, then notice that and realize that's not helpful. So it's mindfulness to understand sort of the whole feeling tone of everything we usually lay on ourselves and what the alternative feels like. Some of it is, it's almost like they do role playing, you know, like imagine you have a message to deliver to your very best friend who's sitting in the chair next to you. Do you say it the way you say it to yourself? If it were you, no. How would you, like, you know, so, and then part of it, which I think is very crucial for me and my thinking, is part of self-compassion is a sense of, this is like human behavior. This is part of being a human being. We make mistakes, we falter, we say the wrong thing, whatever it might be. So it's realizing in a way the universality of our vulnerability and not feeling it's just me, which seems really crucial. I was doing a program with Parker Palmer, and at the end of it, he invited everyone to turn on their microphones and say to one another, welcome to the human race, you know. So it's a little bit about that. And so the ingredient is kindness, and that's what makes for self-compassion. It's not like laziness, like some people think.
Right. Definitely not laziness. I would just thanks, Sharon, for that summary. It's really helpful. And it takes me back to the moment of despair that I had as a young psychiatrist when I quit psychiatry for a while. And I think it was my mindfulness practice that actually opened up enough self-compassion for me to take a pause and reassess, what am I actually doing here? And what I learned in the time that I took off was that I was in despair because I was so frustrated with the merry-go-round of changing medications with people and not seeing the results. And I needed to exercise the self-compassion to reorient, like you said, and take that risk of realignment into what Keith was saying is kind of stepping into what was more aligned in my values, which was going out and learning how to add more tools to my toolkit as a practitioner. And once I shifted into learning mode, and I think a lot of healers are kind of lifelong learners and can probably relate to this, is I just was on fire, and it really shifted into more inspiration. And that's been fairly consistent over time, that the mission to improve mental health care is a sustaining kind of fire under me.
Yeah, I might add to that. In my career, I never felt burned out. Somehow I got that part right. But in my personal life, in my mind, I very much was in an inner war and torture for a lot of my adulthood. And so self-compassion for me was a huge journey. And really, some of the things that I learned around that journey, around when you're really suffering and struggling, and what does self-compassion look like? One of my takeaways was it kind of felt like a prostration to myself, like inside, just kind of bowing down and ask, like basically saying mercy and just saying like, I'm yielding here. And sort of that inner relationship of just, I think we use a lot of words for this kind of letting go, a softening, kind of a bowing down, a yielding. I think that was a major part of my healing. But then I think the second half of the healing was also knowing when to get back up out of the prostration and be like, I'm also taking a stand for change and growth, and taking a stand for bringing, you know, as we say, right effort to this situation, and trying to love myself along the way. So it's definitely, I think, a major part is self-compassion, and not to get absorbed in self-compassion at the same time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's fabulous. So how are you reaching people these days? Is it all online?
Well, Will and I mostly right now, our work mostly is we run an institute, which is an educational institute. So that is almost entirely online now. So, you know, people that take our programs in the Psychiatry Institute, we've shifted all of that to online. But our clinic, where we do other work, we do a lot of different kinds of work. We do psychiatry there. We also use ketamine, which is psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. That's still in person, mostly for the ketamine, because, you know, we very much stand behind wanting to be there with the person if we're going to use that as a cathartic experience to try and help them move forward. And then, you know, we both have some individual work here and there online. So yeah, mostly we're online these days.
And how do you find that in terms of a feeling of connection and the help you're trying to impart?
Yeah, it's challenging to, I don't know what actually happens with my oxytocin levels, but they probably don't go up as much in a horizontal, two-dimensional format, working with people through telemedicine. It's definitely different. I think that, you know, Keith and I are fortunate that we are kind of in a pod together and we get to work together. Mm-hmm. That helps a lot. I think it's so hard for people who are experiencing the kind of isolation that's actually extremely common right now to be able to feel that connection with each other.
Yeah, it's sort of like a forced retreat. It's kind of like for now, like over a year, where it's, and a lot of people don't have the tools for that. And on top of it, that's, you know, that lack of social engagement in the physical space, it's very challenging, I think, for a lot of people. So I would say it's definitely different. It's challenging. And it's opened new opportunities in different ways because people are reaching out in ways that they wouldn't before. There's definitely opportunities there, but I think we are facing, you know, a big challenge around isolation. When you isolate nervous systems, which really operate in synergy, our nervous systems, they do better if they're around healthy nervous systems. So when you start disconnecting people like this, especially with people who don't have a ton of tools that have been practicing for this moment, it can get very overwhelming very fast. Yeah. And we're seeing that. We have the type of patients that come to our clinic now and what we're hearing out there, things are way up right now. People are struggling because of this. And that's why I'm, you know, really love what you do, Sharon, and, you know, your podcast. It's like people really need to hear right now, like, how do you work with yourself? When we're disconnecting one of the most important things, which is social connection, it's a big challenge that we're facing right now.
And the levels of anxiety and depression are so high right now. And we're seeing people who were stable for years coming back and needing more services, huge flood of new people who've never sought psychiatric services before coming in. And it's scary out there. I mean, it's a huge pandemic of mental health challenges right now.
Right. And we probably have more to come. And there is an anecdote to the social isolation. And the anecdote is that if people are able to really focus on what's important to them, even while they're socially isolated, and they can stay in their values, if they have the capacity to do that, and it depends on their situation, it helps regulate the nervous system, and it really helps, you know, keep people more relaxed because they still feel like their destiny is still coming to fruition the way that they want.
Can you give us an example? Like, because sure. I would say, like, let's say my deepest value is love, you know, to contribute some love into this world. And so tell me more.
So I would say to you, Sharon, that have more podcast episodes so that you can share your love into the world. And the more you do that, you're feeling the expression of that value. And the more you feel the expression of that value, the more it will ground you into living into the expression of what's important to you. And so there will still be anxiety, maybe, of the lack of social connection and things like that. But it does anchor us into a purpose that extends into the future. You know, for me, like an example is that, you know, I really kind of focused in on wanting to reach more people in the Institute. That's just what was very important to me. I also have a 2-year-old daughter and a wife, and my 2-year-old went through COVID as a 1-2. And so I focused on her a lot. And so that was enriching to me. There's a lot of ways that this could look for people. There are a lot of parents that have their children at home and they're having to back off on their work. So in that case, you know, sometimes what I would work with those people is finding out how high on their values is their family. Because if it's pretty on their values, we can help them link consciously how spending more time can be fulfilling. Sometimes we just don't have the conscious links enough in our brain to recognize that we're actually already fulfilled during the day. We just didn't really link it enough to what's important to us.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's because I'm trying to think of somebody who really does feel very alone, and maybe the ordinary avenues available to them are not available to them because they're still not traveling around. And so, what would you suggest? I kind of think this is like a story I tell where I almost did it intuitively. The last day that I was in New York City before I left to come up here to Massachusetts, I was teaching somewhere, and the system of this place was that the speaker sits in the audience until they get up on the stage after they've been introduced. And so I was in the audience, and the woman I was sitting next to was very anxious about being there. Nobody quite knew anything, you know, too clearly. And so I said, well, you know, there are breathing techniques that I understand can really help settle your nervous system and have the parasympathetic nervous system be more pronounced than the sympathetic nervous system. And, you know, and it really involves, as far as I understand, having your out-breath be longer than your in-breath. And she was not interested in that. So then I said, well, you know, there's loving kindness meditation, which can really help reinforce that sense of connection. She wasn't interested in that either. And I just looked at her and heard come out of my mouth, is there anyone you can help? And she lit up and she got like completely radiant and said, oh yeah, you know, I have this elderly neighbor and maybe I can slip a note under their door and see if I can do grocery shopping for them. And, but so often people, you know, perhaps might not know. So that may be part of the work initially, is what really lights you up? You know, what do you care about?
Absolutely. I mean, the relief, I think you're speaking to something really important, Sharon, in the relief that we feel immediately when we turn our attention to what can I do for other people inside of the suffering that I'm feeling. Not as a bypass or a, you know, changing the channel kind of phenomenon, but balancing the despair, the suffering, the loneliness with what can I do for another person right now? And the shift that we feel in our system when we activate that kind of compassion.
Yeah, I'm reminded of a person I worked with probably a decade ago, pre-COVID, obviously, who had severe social anxiety. So already suffering, obviously, from severe isolation. And you know, I was doing much of what you described, and it was helpful to a degree. You know, I was really trying to help him mindfully get into contact with his experience to regulate himself, and that was helpful. But I think the big shift in that case, when I think back, this reminded me from your description, it reminded me, the big shift started coming. His claim was what he wanted more than anything in life was connection. And I assume that was true. But when I actually decided to challenge that, because I did see he had an injury in learning how to connect with people. But when I challenged that and said, maybe there's something more important to you than just connecting with people. When we discovered what that was, and I started helping him with that, and that was more around a purpose that wasn't just about relationships. Some people's purpose is relationship. We started to move, and he started to get regulated more, calmer, and eventually started to be able to connect more with people once we helped him more focus on like what's going to light him up versus kind of focusing on like, how do I get out of this dark hole by trying to sort of, you know, build something into the hole. It was just like, wait, maybe we're poking around the wrong hole here for the moment, and we'll come back to that. So I think there's a lot going on here. You know, we've got a lot of people facing isolation right now in different ways. I think it's a huge challenge, and there is an opportunity when we're presented with isolation. And obviously, Sharon, you've been a meditator for most of your life. So obviously, you probably know there's so much about the opportunity that comes when we go inward and isolate in ourselves to see what's there. Yeah.
You know, so a lot of this, as I listen, has another theme, which is destigmatizing care for mental suffering. You know, that it's going to be right now, as you've described, you know, growing and growing and growing, that hopefully people will seek to have some help and be able to find a way to have more fulfillment and connection and love in their lives, even as they're going through something very difficult. And so I think about that reluctance to seek treatment, to find help, or just the way mental suffering is viewed in such a different light than physical suffering. And I just wonder if you could say something about that.
You know, this is a really important topic for Will and I, because with the creation of modern psychiatric diagnoses, which is really what we talk about when we say mental health issues and mental suffering and destigmatization, as beneficial as that was in some ways to sort of categorize and do some research and things like that, we also ended up creating culturally, globally, a new framework for, are you okay or are you not okay? And if you fit in to a mental health disorder, you're not okay. But in reality, we're all on a spectrum of moving between suffering and health all the time. And everyone, if we really wanted to look at their life, at some point in their life, will have a mental health disorder from that framework. At some point, we could find a mental health disorder at some point in their life. So to me, there was a big drawback to that framework, that now we have a lot of stigmatization around mental health. And the problem is it doesn't encourage a human being to go get the support they need to thrive, that framework. And so that's a part of our work, is reframing the conversation around mental health, wellness, spiritual wellness, physical wellness. We really need to move into a wellness model and a spectrum model. You know, where are you on the spectrum right now? And what do you need if you want to thrive more? And don't get into fantasy that you're not going to ever be hurting again, because you are. We're going to all be moving through periods of inspiration and struggle inside ourselves. And for us, it's all about what's the way to get back into inspiration as fast as possible. Can you get better and better at that throughout your life? So I don't know, do you want to add anything there, Will? I mean, you've been steeped in this world for so long in medicine, right? About mental health.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're pointing out something really important, Sharon, when you talk about stigmatization and the reluctance to get help. And I just want to highlight, as a physician and as a mental health provider, that it's especially stigmatizing often for therapists and providers of care, because, I mean, there's practical issues where, you know, your license to practice might be questioned if you're perceived to have a so-called, you know, major depressive disorder or some kind of mental health diagnosis. That's on the practical level. But you also have to deal with crossing the line in your own mind from provider to patient. And so that's why Keith and I really feel like this model that includes everyone in the community, you know, the global community of suffering beings works a lot better than this kind of artificial separation between the provider and the patient, because we all need help and we all suffer.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation. I think it was enlightening, shall we say, and I think you helped a lot of people, truly. So I'm wondering if one of you can lead us in a guided meditation to close out our conversation.
Sure, I would love to do that. Take a deep, long inhale and a relaxed exhale. And reflect on this statement. At the end of your life, when you're reflecting back on it, what's the absolute most important contribution you would have wanted to make in your lifetime? At the end of your life, when you reflect back on it, what's the most important contribution you would have wanted to have made in this lifetime? And breathe that in and let it go in your exhale. And just notice, is that contribution in the area of a family or spirituality or your health or your career and how you're serving or your lifestyle? And just breathe that in and take an exhale and let it go. And take another deep breath in and let it go. And reflect again on how your behaviors today are leading toward that contribution in your life. What behaviors did you do this morning that are on the way of you contributing in this huge way in your lifetime? What behaviors yesterday are on the way to this huge contribution in your lifetime? Taking another deep breath in and letting that go. And notice how your entire life is on the way to the contribution you want to give in this lifetime. Breathing that in, exhaling, and letting that go. Thank you.
Thank you so much for leading that, both of you, for joining me today. To learn more about Will and Keith's work, you can tune into Higher Practice Podcast at www.psychiatryinstitute.com/podcast or wherever you listen to your podcasts. A big thank you to everybody listening here. This has been the Metta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, be happy, be healthy, and may you live with ease.
Hey folks, thanks for listening. To learn more about Sharon and her ongoing teaching schedule, as well as online courses and a free guided meditation, check out her website at sharonsalzberg.com.